Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
Everybody, welcome to Lost River Legends. We're glad that you're able to join us today. We have a special guest, Brian Forrester, on with us today. Let's just get right into the interview. Brian, welcome to Lost River Legends. How are you today?
I'm very fine. Thank you very much.
We're just getting off Thanksgiving break, and it sounds like you're busy down in Peru.
Yeah, I've been living here for about 12 years.
How's the weather down there today?
Very beautiful. It's about 75 to 80 Fahrenheit and sunny skies.
And for those of you who don't know, really quick, Brian, could you give us just maybe like a 30,000 foot view of the Paracas skulls, just a quick intro into what they are, where they were located, and some of the outlying pieces that really stand out?
Okay, well, basically, there was a culture that lived here on the coast of Peru between about 800 BC to 100 AD, and archaeologists have called them the Paracas culture because of the name of the area, and they were very advanced socially, and the strange characteristics about them is that the royal class of these people had elongated heads and were much taller than other local native people. So what I've been able to figure out is that the original people actually were born with elongated heads, and then over the course of time, they started to breed with normal-looking people, and that's when they began the process of cranial deformation to alter the shape of the baby's heads to be elongated.
And so with the Paracas skulls, I know one of the things that you and L.A. Marzulli have talked about is the missing sagittal suture of these skulls, which is prominent in regular skulls. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. Basically all Homo sapiens sapiens, as in us, have what's called a sagittal or parietal suture. And that's a line that goes down... connects to another suture across your forehead and then goes backwards to the back of the skull. But in the original Paracas ones, there is no suture at all.
And that's intriguing because that's something that occurs during the growth of the skeleton as these bone structures come together.
Yeah, that's right. The two sutures are like in a T shape. And the reason for or what their function is a newborn baby has to, of course, have a very soft head in order to go out of the birth canal. And so over the course of about 2.5 to 3 years, the calcification or the bone grows to the point where the sutures connect with each other, and that finishes the formation of the human skull. But in the case of the Paracas, with one of these sutures missing, it probably means that the mother's whole hip area would be different from normal.
Interesting. And with the skulls themselves, I know that there's been talk about cradle headboarding and this binding that happens in some cultures. Is there anything that happens to the skull during these bindings or these cradle headboardings that would have any significance in that sagittal suture?
As far as I can tell, yes. And I've shown the skulls to numerous foreign doctors who have come to visit me, and they don't understand how the suture can't be there. There are lots of different cultures in the past that have done cradle headboarding in North America and Europe and many different locations. But in all of those cases, except the Paracas and possibly the area of the Black Sea, the cradle headboarding simply changes the shape of the skull. It's flattening of the forehead and the back of the skull. But in the case of the Paracas, They are, or they originated as literal cone heads, and over the course of time, with breeding with common people, they began to do the cradle headboarding operation or process in order to maintain a physical difference between the royal class of people and the common people.
So what you're saying is these Paracas skulls, they were of royal descent.
Yeah, actually, in every case I've been able to study, the cradle headboarding was done only to the nobility, not to the common people, and that's especially the case in the Paracas. A huge difference between the look of the original Paracas skulls and what we commonly think of as a normal human skull, or even one that's been headboarded.
Interesting. And so I had another question for you. So besides the skulls, were there any other parts of the skeletal structure that would belong to these skulls that were found at this site? And if so, are there any features of the skeleton that are different or as just bizarre as the skulls themselves?
Well, the whole vertebral column or neck going into the foramen magnum, which is the hole in the bottom of the skull, is about half the diameter of normal, which is very odd. And experts that I've been discussing this with believe that their necks were actually quite a bit longer than normal.
And we see that. I've noticed that I've pulled up some of Marcia Moore's work and some of her interpretations on how these Paracas people would look based on some kind of digital reconstruction based off the skulls. And there's, you know, the cheekbones are different, the forehead, it's straight back from the brow. It's pretty amazing the work that she's been able to do to interpret what these people look like.
Yeah, actually, the great thing that she's doing now is she's actually doing 3D reconstruction using exact castings of the Paracas skulls. And so that's her earlier work was all digital, but now she's moving to true facial reconstruction.
Wow, that's incredible. There's going to be a higher level of accuracy doing it that way, I would imagine.
I think so, because she's been at this for I think 5 years now, or maybe even longer. So she's getting better and better as she goes.
One of the other things that I was curious about, and it's something that's completely I'm enamored with to a certain point, is were there any artifacts connected to these people that were found at the site or near the site that might shed a little bit more light on who these people were?
Well, they were basically a Bronze Age culture. We find bronze and gold ornaments and things like that. But in general, most of their tools were stone and not that elegantly made. But the textiles are absolutely phenomenal. They're probably the finest textiles ever created in the Americas at that time.
And so there's tools and then there's clothing artifacts that have been found at the site that are tied to these people. Are there any structures or any megaliths that can tell us any additional information from these people and their cultures?
Yeah, they basically lived on the coast of Peru, which is desert. Not a lot of stone, but lots of sand. So they built quite large adobe pyramidal shapes. In some cases, 80 to 100 feet tall, and there are still remains of those in this area.
That's interesting. And have you I'm assuming you've studied those sites and been able to glean some information from that.
Yeah, I live about half an hour from the major Paracas habitations.
Wow. A little playground there for you go to anytime,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
So one of the most recent DNA tests that I know that you and L.A. Marzulli were a part of. I believe it was February of this year that the information was let out to the public. Is there any consensus in your particular community as to what these people were? Or is it just open up more questions based off the DNA results?
It actually does both because, according to standard academia, all pre-Columbian people, at least from Mexico all the way down to the southern tip of South America, were of four haplogroups, and that's a description of your ancestry. So they were either A, B, C, or D. But the interesting thing about doing the testing was that we did 19 different skulls, and only three of them turned out to be in one of those four groups, and only B. So all of the other haplogroups that showed up are actually most common in the Black Sea Crimea area of Eurasia.
So, what does that tell us about the skulls, about these people?
It probably tells us that people were migrating from Eurasia to the coast of Peru around 1000 BC, so 3000 years ago. And that's, very different from common history, because most, again, academics believe that all Native American people, that their ancestors crossed the Bering Land Bridge from Siberia, and that there was no ocean movement until the Spanish showed up on the coast of Peru in 1532 AD.
You know, and a lot of that is validated because some of these skulls actually have, the hair color of these skulls is different than what we would associate with a native, in that area. We have red hair, and I think that there was some blonde hair that was found, wasn't there?
Oh yeah. Actually, all of the ancient nobility of Paracas appear to have had an auburn red hair, which is genetic, or even I've seen examples of blonde ones. And two different experts in hair study, academics, have studied the hair, and they say it's much more Caucasian than it is Native American.
And I know that there was some people that were claiming that there was some bleaching going on, and that's just not the case in this because it is genetic. There's no outside source that is changing the hair other than the genetics themselves.
Yeah, that's right. Because red hair or lightish red hair, when exposed to the sun, can go blondish, and dark blonde can go very light blonde. But black will never become red. It's unless actual dyes are added to the hair, black hair always remains black, even if it's 2,000 plus years old.
Interesting. Well, yeah, that just leaves a lot more open. It adds additional questions in my pursuit of this, and as I, in my, I'm not studying it on any level even close to you or even LA, but just kind of an armchair researcher. But that's still something that is very bizarre about that. And as we talk about, these skulls and especially the DNA testing, because there's been more than one DNA test that has been done on these skulls. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, three different labs were involved in the results that came out in February. Three labs were used, and we got results from two of the labs. The third lab were given something like 18 samples, and they made a statement that no results were obtained, but I think the honest truth about that is they were very unhappy with the results that came out, because they're quite bizarre and groundbreaking.
Exactly. And you when you sent these samples in to be tested, there was no real information given other than there was no pictures of the skulls attached. There was no really not a lot of information for them to go off of. So they couldn't jump to any conclusions necessarily.
No, that's true. LA and his forensic team were the ones who did most of the testing. And as far as I know, they just sent the sample. I'm sure all the labs knew that these were South American samples, but they weren't told specifically the location or anything like that. They were simply given samples with numbers on them.
That's fascinating. And I think that's the way that you need to do it because, a lot of these DNA tests about these bizarre findings, whether it be the Paracas skulls or anything else, the less information that's given to the lab that's doing the testing, I think is better because it gives you a cleaner process and gives you cleaner results.
Yeah, that's very true.
And one other thing I wanted to ask you about the skulls before we move on to the next subject is there was something that I was I had a friend of mine that brought this to my attention, something about the maternal side of the DNA of these skulls. What, and can you expand a little bit more on that?
Sure. Well, actually, from the maternal side, we get mitochondrial DNA, which is not that difficult to obtain. But in order to get the paternal side, you need nuclear DNA, and we were not able to get that from any of the samples because it's very, very difficult. But the testing is ongoing, so hopefully in the future we'll be able to get some paternal DNA. But the maternal by itself is so odd that it's, and we did, as I said, 19 different skulls, so that the results are quite compelling.
And that leads to kind of an extraterrestrial hypothesis in regards to the skulls because of the speculation of their origin and the findings of the DNA. What's the latest information on that hypothesis that you've been involved with?
Well, the largest elongated skulls in the world are located in two places. One is Paracas on the coast of Peru, and the other is the Black Sea of Eurasia. They look almost identical. So I'm going to be going to that part of the world in September of next year and see if I can take my own photographs of the elongated skulls for comparison and look for other characteristics such as larger eye sockets, which the Paracas have, the missing suture, and also these two small holes in the back of the skull, which seem to be for blood and nerve flow. So that's what's coming up.
The samples that you mentioned on the Black Sea, have there been any DNA testing done on those, or is it just the ones in Peru?
Just the ones in Peru, as far as I know, but that's obviously something that I'm going to pursue with my Russian colleagues who want to get very active, I think, once I get there.
So what are the next steps that you and your colleagues have planned for testing and working? Because I know that you have to work with the Peruvian archaeologists and have certain permissions to access the samples. Is there any additional information you can tell us about some of that work you might be doing?
Yeah, we're going to be continuing to do testing, but probably in smaller numbers, like one or two at a time. And I plan to pursue that for for decades to come.
Yeah, it's something that's just completely fascinating to me, is just, you know, you have the DNA, you have the physical aspects of the skull, and these things just keep adding more curiosity to themselves as we go along.
Yeah, that's true. It is basically my main pursuit. And so living in the area, of course, gives me the advantage of being able to access other skulls coming up. And now we have a very good crew that are working in harmony together to just continue this process.
Yeah, that's great. We appreciate your work doing that. It's something that there's a lot of people out there that are completely intrigued with. And I, for one, have been following it for as long as I can. And I kind of wanted to shift away from the Paracas skulls for a little bit, if we can. And I know that on your YouTube channel, you're publishing a lot of lectures and content on megalithic structures around the world, and finding certain aspects of these structures, these sites that contain very anomalous findings as far as how they're built, what they're built out of, and who built them, and I was hoping that I could ask you a question about that.
Sure.
So a lot of these, and for those that might not be familiar, we'll try to send some links on our website and on the show notes here to some of Brian's work on YouTube, so you can see pictures and you can see his discussions on that. But in some of these sites, these blocks of stone, of various types of stone, most of them are very, very hard stone, are taken off-site, not off-site, but they're harvested off-site, brought on-site, and built into the structure. And so One of the things that has completely blown me away is the things that you're bringing to light are tool marks. You see holes drilled into these stones in granite and other hard stones. You see various saw marks that are left on the surface of many of these stones. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think, what technology might be involved with this?
Okay, especially in Egypt, around the Giza Plateau area, and at Baalbek in Lebanon, and Petra in Jordan, we see machining tool marks. So it's not a question of hand tools, it's a question of very advanced technology that existed several thousand years before it's supposed that anything like that existed. So, for example, diamond tools were only invented, I think, in the 1860s, and we see machining technology of that level or even far beyond in those three locations. And what's interesting about Peru, or the highlands of Peru, is that the megalithic structures we see there about 95%, or actually 98% of the cases, we don't see tool marks at all. So that's a different kind of technology that was involved.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because you look at you in your lectures, you obviously show slides of pictures that you've taken of the joints of stones that are placed together, these walls, and the fit and finish of these is just completely incredible. I mean, you say that you can't even fit a human hair, a sheet of paper, a needle in between these, and to not see any tool marks on a larger percentage of these is staggering. It's perplexing.
Oh, very much. I was just actually in Cusco, which was the capital of the Inca, and the Sacred Valley, which is nearby. I just actually left there yesterday, so I was with a group of 150 people with a physicist called Nassim Harriman, and we were all looking at it at different locations like Ollantaytambo and Sacsayhuaman and in the city of Cusco itself, and none of them were able to explain away how this work could have been done using conventional technology, and especially not at the time that academics think that they were done.
So you mentioned that there's some tools, hand tools that have been found, and I know that in some of your presentations you have photos of chisels and mallets and different things that are used as hand tools. But as far as some of these other tools, as far as we can explain, you know, we talk about diamond or some kind of some tool that is made out of something that needs to be harder than the stone itself in order for it to be cut, chiseled, shaped, what have you. Are there any indications of tools such as diamond dust or anything in the site itself that could validate any of this? Because obviously these sites have left evidence of a higher technology than what we normally would assume with these people. But there's no, in a lot of these cases, there's just not the tools that are left over. How can we explain that? Were they taken off site after everything was built? Were they, you know, it's just perplexing to me.
Yeah, well, that's the only tools that we find from ancient Egypt or ancient Peru are bronze chisels. And so their hardness is about 3.5 out of 10, and 10 is diamond. So the stone that was being cut and shaped is at least 6 or 7 or 7.5 in hardness. And so there's no way that bronze tools can make any impact whatsoever on stone of that hardness. So again, that's why we say it had to be diamond technology, or even in some cases, way beyond that, and that's not explainable by conventional academic research.
Yeah, and it just adds more perplexing questions. It seems as more discoveries come out, and as more information is derived from these sites. One of the other questions I had for you that has just completely fascinated me with these sites, and in particular with your work, is you mentioned that there's in many of these sites, there's there's scarring or damage to some of these sites and structures that suggest a high heat. I think you've mentioned solar flares or some kind of super high solar event that might have occurred, because we see scarring on these structures. Is there any information you can tell us about that and what some of your hypotheses are?
Yeah, it's actually every location that we go to, whether it's again in Egypt or in Peru or in Bolivia, we see evidence of ancient cataclysmic activity where the structures have been broken by enormous force. And in some cases, we see the bubbling of the stone surface. So that tells us that there were different things that happened in these locations, like massive earthquakes, and also the possibility of solar bursts of plasma from the sun. And the dating, we're getting more and more scientific dating about this being exactly at the end of the last ice age. And that was 12,000 years ago. So that's twice as old as any civilization that we conventionally know of.
Yeah, that's super interesting to me. And one of the questions that I had while you were presenting on this in one of your lectures was, you know, at these varying sites, you said that all of the sites have some sort of common damage with something that was related to high heat or solar. Is there any correlation to a direction of where this solar event occurred or where this cataclysm occurred that might tell us what direction it might have come from? Did it come from the north on a lot of these sites? Did it come from the south? Was it from the top? Can you tell us any information about that?
Yeah, the commonality with some locations in Peru and also in Egypt is that it came from the east, so it came from the sunrise. And we see that especially at the Ramesseum in Egypt, and also the Temple of Karnak, you see the scorching of the surface of the stone itself. In some cases, the stone has been flash high heated and then it expanded and cracked. So there is the remains of an obelisk at Karnak that is now in several pieces. And if you pick up a piece of the remains from the ground, it'll crumble in your hand. And we're talking about granite, which is a very tough and dense and compacted material. So clearly that location and some others were struck by a super hot flash of intense instantaneous heat.
And that just, it's something that there's obvious something that's there because the evidence is there, something happened, and these sites aren't necessarily in close proximity to one another. And so that just adds more perplexing questions to the whole event.
Yeah, and that's why it requires several visits to the locations to get more and more information as we go. So that is why, for example, I visit Egypt once a year, and I visit the locations in the highlands of Peru usually four or five times a year.
You know, and that's something that leads me to my next point, is there's a lot of archaeologists that you've talked about that seemingly turned a blind eye to a lot of these curious findings on these sites. Why is mainstream archaeology shying away from really trying to find the truth?
Because it doesn't fit their paradigm. So, for example, they're still, in general, insisting that the Great Pyramid in Egypt was constructed 4,500 years ago by manual labor or slaves. And then in Peru, that all of the megalithic work was done between 500 and 1,000 years ago. And they will not budge, and they don't bother trying to debate me. They simply ignore the data. And so in response to that, I simply collect more data.
Yeah, and it's frustrating because the work is so important to find out more information about these people, the sites, who built them, how they built them, and the fact that most of these individuals are just turning a blind eye It just seems like they're just more involved about the tourism aspect of these sites than they are the actual truth, and that's frustrating.
It is, but the best response to it is to just keep, is not to get frustrated, but to just keep going and collecting more data as we go. And there is a sea change occurring, and that's why I do the YouTube thing, is that it's the best format for presenting the information to a global audience, because this is our common human heritage that we're talking about. So all of this information belongs to everyone. It shouldn't go to just a specific class of people who then will disseminate to the public if they choose to. And in a lot of cases, they simply don't choose to. So that's what I and many others are doing, is presenting it to the world.
Yeah, I'm a very curious individual. I really want to find the truth, and I really am interested in studying these topics and finding out as much information as I can. And people like yourself that have done so much work, that are boots on the ground, you're on site, you're publishing content. We just can't thank you enough, because there's just not enough of us out there that can do that. And for the few that can do that, it's priceless.
Yeah, well, the audience is growing quite rapidly. People, I think, are starting to wake up more and more. And that's why, for example, we had 150 people from around the world in Cusco yesterday and 5 days before that. I left the group and have come back home. But yesterday, today, and tomorrow, I think they're all exploring Machu Picchu, which also has a megalithic core to it. So that's, I think, the best way to get the information out.
Yeah, I want to say it was about 22 years ago, I had the privilege to travel to Mexico, and I was able to visit Chichen Itza and some of the sites surrounding that. And that was really my first taste of finding, being at a place that just, I was speechless the whole time. I just walked around, and it really takes, how do I say this? It really is a special time when you can visit these sites in person. It's just, it really adds more to the whole curiosity.
Yeah, definitely. The best thing to do is to visit the places yourself, because then you see with your own eyes the evidence. And some of my recent explorations have been in Mexico, and there are some megalithic aspects to places like Palenque and Teotihuacan and some other locations in Oaxaca and also the Yucatan that show that the original constructors were megalithic builders, and then later the people we commonly know of as the Olmec and the Aztec and the Maya were inheritors of the ancient places.
Exactly. Yeah, there's just so much for us to learn about ancient civilization, and it takes a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of resources, and people like you and LA and others that are working so hard. It just fascinates me that there's just so much out there that's hidden from us, and so much for us to learn about where we came from and why we're here.
Well, and luckily it's hidden no more thanks to the internet. So all of this will
so true.
Be expanding. Yeah, it'll be expanding more and more as time goes on. More people will come on board, and eventually history books will, even if books continue to exist in the future, but the information will be available on an accelerating basis.
That is very true. And the internet itself has really brought many walls down, opened up communication and education to a levels that I don't think anyone anticipated. It's pretty marvelous, actually.
Yeah, it's astonishing. And I don't think there's some people say, well, it'll be blocked or something. But I think there is no way to stop it. It'll keep becoming more and more. It is the most important resource that does exist, because in the past, in order to do research, we've had to travel to different locations and then also do research in a library and then compile it together in a book form. And now stuff like YouTube are absolutely phenomenal. YouTube contains much more information than all the libraries of the world put together.
It's fascinating. And for people that are doing work similar to what you're doing, and they're using that medium, it really helps everyone else have access to that, to see what's going on, to see what the latest and greatest is, and to get more questions answered. It's pretty great.
Oh, you bet.
Well, I wish we could talk more. I have a ton of questions, but I know that our time is limited, and I can't thank you enough for being on with us today to share some of your knowledge about the Paracas and some of these megalithic sites. And again, we just can't thank you enough, and we appreciate everything that you're doing out there and the information that you're sharing with the world. It's priceless.
Okay, well, thank you. Please contact me in 6 months and we can continue on with more.
Perfect. I will do that. I promise. All right. Thanks, Brian. You have a great day, and thanks for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
You too. My pleasure.
Everybody, we appreciate you listening to today's episode with Brian Forrester. We just want to give a big thanks to Brian for the work that he's doing in Peru, Bolivia, Egypt, and in other parts of the world. If you want to find out more information about the work that Brian's doing, we have links on this episode's show notes on our website, LostRiverLegends.com. If you've had a strange encounter and you'd like to be on the show, you can reach us at LostRiverLegends@gmail.com. In addition to our Gmail address, we actually have a more secure way of contacting us, LostRiverLegends@ProtonMail.com. This is an email platform that encrypts messages to and from senders, so if you have sensitive information that you want to pass to us, then please consider this option for communication. In addition to this, we just wanted to let our listeners know that Lost River Legends is now on Patreon. We have links to our Patreon account on this episode in the show notes, so if you have any way of supporting us in this channel, we would certainly appreciate it. And lastly, we wanted to let our listeners know that Dr. Jeff Meldrum from Idaho State University will be our upcoming guest on our next episode. Myself, along with James, are going to be traveling down to Pocatello, Idaho to sit down and visit with Dr. Meldrum in person. We're excited for the opportunity and the time that Dr. Meldrum has allowed to visit with us. We're not sure what that episode's going to look like right now, but it may end up being a two-part episode, so stay tuned for that. And again, we just want to thank all our listeners for supporting us and listening to our content. If you feel so inclined, we would appreciate to see how we're doing. You can visit our social channels, reach out to us, and comment and subscribe. We would appreciate it. And until next time, everyone stay safe. Bye.